stand for the pledge?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Jessica, if you could do the roll call, please.
Lassiter.
Here.
Nemechek.
Here.
Conklin.
Here.
Moody.
Here.
Needhammer.
Here.
Quorum present.
Okay, great. So we have no public here to comment, so we can move right into the audit overview. Jessica?
I'll start off if that's okay.
Sure.
A number of years ago, the City Commission thought, rather than just have an audit presentation at the regular commission meeting, that some more in-depth discussion would be helpful. So they set up these work sessions to meet with our auditors, and this is Joe Verlin, our auditor, and he'll introduce himself here in just a second. To kind of answer any questions that the commission might have with regards to the audit and kind of walk us through it, maybe a little bit more detailed level than what we do in the meeting for the general public overall. So I really don't want to steal any of Joe's thunder. He's here to answer any questions that you may have. The only thing I would suggest that if anybody has any initial big questions they want to get out on the table, like we at least toss them out now. If you happen to have one in your mind right now, then Joe can work that into his presentation, and obviously you can ask him a question anytime you go through it. Cindy's here. I've asked her to be here because Cindy was here when we put the budget together and implemented most of the budget that we're reviewing through the audit. That was the budget book. Is kind of, here's where we project things to go, and this is kind of the final word as we close the door and say, here's where we actually ended up. So for this fiscal year that we're looking at, the fiscal year that ended April 30th of this year, Cindy was mainly involved with that. Jessica's mainly involved with this year's budget and the audit that will be coming next year. So it's kind of a transition year. So in case there's any questions, I thought it might be helpful to have Cindy here as well, too. But that's all I've got, unless somebody has something for me.
Well, Joe, I'm Hugh, and I was elected mayor a few weeks ago, and we have three new commissioners. We have Marty Moody here, George Lassiter, and Tim Nemechek.
Hello.
So they're new, and we're getting to know each other, and we're into our third meeting here, and we're looking forward to hearing about the audit. And you know, this is an important part of what the city does,
sure.
And to understand it is really important. And you know, we appreciate you being here. And
yeah, always glad to be here. It's always a pleasure working with the city staff. Again, as it has been in the past, everybody does a wonderful job of providing us the information to work through the entire audit cycle. One thing that is unique with the city of Boyne City is, if you turn to page 7, I'm just going to walk through the report, kind of hitting on the financial highlights. I won't go through all 110 pages of it, but like Mike said, if there's any questions, don't hesitate to ask. This is the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. This is something that, when the city initially issued its request for proposals for auditing services many years ago, it was something that was kind of on the wish list for the city to go and pursue this, because it's a way of separating the city from other municipalities in the state of Michigan. 276 cities in the state of Michigan, 55 of them get this award. I just looked it up today to see how many. So roughly 20% of the cities in the state of Michigan do this. What this means is that, in addition to conducting the annual required audit report, the city prepares an introductory letter, and I know that Mike puts an awful lot of time into drafting that letter. Gives an awful lot of information about the demographics and some of the underlying economic driving activities that are ongoing in the city. Various other, charts of accounts. Much information about the city is included in an introductory section. And then in the back end of the report, there's about 18 to 20 pages of statistical information. So it shows 10-year trend data, in terms of where the city's fund balance has been, where the city's net position has been, top taxpayers, top employers, things of that nature, just to give users a really good understanding of not only the finances, but some of the just the underlying economic conditions that are driving your finances. So it's far more transparent than a typical audit report. It requires an awful lot of extra effort to get to this point. And then once it's all compiled and put together, it gets submitted to the GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association. They send it through a stringent review process. They vote on whether or not to approve it and accept it. And then at, about 6 months after it gets submitted, a final decision gets made as to whether or not the city earns the award. So this was the sixth year in a row that the city has received it. April 30, 2021 has been submitted again to the GFOA for the award. So really just kudos to the staff for putting forth the extra effort, increasing transparency, and just making the report as useful as it can be for the residents to work through. Turn now to page 12. We get to the opinion paragraph of the audit report. And in the 110-page report, this is what matters more than anything else. This is essentially where we stamp our seal of approval on the financial statements. This is what we are engaged to do. And we receive the financial statements from the city. We've worked with the county. We've worked with the state of Michigan, the Michigan Department of Transportation, various financial institutions. We confirm, verify the numbers that are provided to us in your financial statements. And if we conclude that the financial statements are fairly presented or accurate, we render a clean opinion on your financial statements. And that's what we have here. So the second paragraph down, we write, in our opinion, based on our audit, the financial statements present fairly, in all material respects, the financial position of the city as of April 30, 2021. It doesn't sound flattering according to the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. It's an unmodified opinion, but I always explain it as being a clean opinion. It just sounds far better than unmodified. In fact, I told a client once we were providing an unmodified opinion on her financial statements, and she was almost in tears and wanted to know what they need to do to make sure that never happens again. And I'm like, oh, this is actually, this is good. This is the gold standard of opinion. So you always should strive to get a clean opinion on your financial statement, on your financial statements, but it does mean something to earn it. It means that you have, the city has suitable controls in place to provide accurate, timely, and verifiable financial statements. So again, it's nice to get the award, but this really is what matters more than anything else in this audit report. So checked out, everything came out clean. The very next paragraph down, we see a change in accounting principle paragraph. This happens maybe every 3 to 5 years. And what happened in April 30, 2021, the Governmental Accounting Standard Board issued statement number 84. It's a new fiduciary activities reporting requirement. Basically, what we did is the city took its tax collection fund, and we show how much taxes the city receives on an annual basis. It goes into the city, and then you, in turn, remit it to various other local units, the government, the county, the FSD, the school, the state of Michigan. Just to give readers an idea of the city, basically, your own revenues are about $10 million, but we wanted to show the readers, or the Governmental Accounting Standard Board wants to show readers how much total cash goes into and out of the city on an annual basis, and that's kind of the second piece of that equation. It never was included in your standard financial statements. This shows that these new funds will show readers the total amount of cash that goes into the city. So I'll point those out when we get to those statements. Not exactly a sweeping change. It doesn't impact your fund balance or your net position. It's just some additional information provided for the readers. Now if we go to page 15. This gets us to the first page of management's discussion and analysis. And this is the second section of the report where the city takes quite a bit of time to pull together some useful information for readers to really get an understanding of what's going on financially in the city. In this section of the report, it's about 10 pages. We get some financial highlights. As you see on page 15, a handful of bullet points kind of showing some of the key numbers. at April 30, 2021. We also, in this section, see comparative financial statements, so you can kind of get an idea of how your numbers are trending, at least over the past couple of audits. In addition to that, there's some narrative explaining reasons behind significant changes. And then the very last paragraph talks about some of the upcoming changes that the city's considering in terms of what's going to impact next year's budget. And that's really where the city does a wonderful job of highlighting to readers of these financial statements what significant is happening at the city that is going to impact. A lot of our clients will just kind of go through and do the bare minimum, but the city really does a really nice job of making that information useful to the readers of the financial statements. So first bullet point, the financial highlights section shows that the city, if you took all the assets of the city and sold them all and paid off all your liabilities, there would be $33,329,130. We call that net position. In the corporate world, we would call this equity. It's a hypothetical number. Obviously, the city has no intention of doing that, and it would be difficult to sell your infrastructure and buildings. But the idea here is to show readers what your total net position is, and more importantly, is it improving or is it going backwards? When we back out the non-liquid assets, so your infrastructure, your restricted amounts for major and local streets and debt service, things of that nature, your unrestricted net position was $6,159,295. That's a much better representation of what your true liquidity was in April 30, 2021 to cover the day-to-day cost of running the city. But that's across all of your funds, not just a general fund. Second bullet point down, like I mentioned, we really want to know, is the city's net position improving or is it going backwards? So we can see that the revenues of the city came in at $10,371,143 and your expenses came in at $8.7 million, leading to an increase in net position of $1,660,754. And if a reader were to ask you, is the city better off at April 30, 2021 than it was at April 30, 2020? The answer to that question would be yes, at $1,660,000. Seeing your revenues exceeding your expenses is good, just like it would be in the corporate world. We would think of that as net income in the corporate world. In the municipal world, we call it an increase in net position, but really kind of synonymous with each other. It means that you're operating at a sustainable level over time.
Is that mostly increased SEV?
That's part of it. So your tax bill values increased by about 2.7%, which are driving up your tax revenues. That certainly is one piece of your improving net position and contributes to it for sure.
Okay. Joe, would that show the revenue that we were reimbursed for the open space property from the state?
Yes. That would include that as operating grants. And I don't recall if that happens in this year's budget or in this year's audited financials or if it was in the previous year. I know that it's included in these financial statements. So when the city gets reimbursed for those grants, I want to say it was last year we picked it up and accrued it in the previous year. Those grant revenues do get picked up. They're treated like revenues, which might seem a little bit odd, but it does fall directly to your bottom line as an increase in that position. Third bullet point, now we're looking at the fund financial statements for the city for the 12 months ended April 30, 2021. And the difference between fund balance and net position. Fund balance, we're looking at what are the city's immediate resources compared to your long-term resources. Your immediate resources primarily being cash. I would think of this as being checkbook accounting. And these are the same financial statements that you would see on a monthly basis when you look at your budget to actual reports. So we're focusing on the very short term. Your governmental funds had fund balances of $3,891,742. Which was an increase of $779,033 for the 12 months ended April 30, 2021. In other words, the cash into the city exceeded your cash out by $779,000 during the course of the year, leading to that increase in fund balance. Fourth bullet point down, now we're looking just at the general fund. So third bullet point is looking at all of the governmental funds. The fourth bullet point is looking just at the general fund. Cash into the general fund exceeded the cash out by $559,625, leading to an increase in your fund balance. And the ending fund balance for the general fund came in at $2,052,590. And now, the last bullet point, that fifth bullet point, is looking at the unassigned fund balance. When we back off the non-spendable and anything that has any type of earmark on fund balance in your general fund, leaves us with the unassigned fund balance after we peel all that back. Unassigned fund balance came in at $1,993,583. When we divide that by your total general fund expenditures and transfers out, the city has 44% funded. 44% of your annualized expenditures set aside in unassigned fund balance. In other words, you've got about 5 months worth of operating reserves to weather the cash gaps that you have inherently throughout the course of the year. Property taxes obviously are seasonal. Your state aid comes in once every 2 months. You've got to have a little bit of unassigned fund balance sitting in reserves to kind of weather those cash gaps throughout the course of the year. The Government Finance Officers Association recommends having a minimum level of 2 months. You guys are at 5 months. So most of our clients are right in that 4 to 6 month range. You guys, not too much, not too little, very healthy, unassigned fund balance at April 30, 2021. If you flip three more pages, we get to page 18.
Joe, could I stop you first? Mike, what has been the commission's
policy?
Target?
Yeah. 25% as a minimum.
Thank you.
Sure. So page 18 shows comparative assets and liabilities for each of the past 2 years. And I'm going to focus on the very last two columns, the total primary government. And we're looking basically across all of the city's funds for both April 30, 2020, and again at April 30, 2021. So very top row cash and investments. We'd like to see that number trending up over time. Came in at $8,147,744 at April 30, 2020. Increased up to $8,841,039 at April 30, 2021. So about a $700,000 increase in your cash and investments during the year. So your net position increased, your fund balances increased, your cash increased as well. And then if you go about to 80% of the way down the page, we get into the non-current liability section. And the very last non-current liability is the city's net pension liability. So at April 30, 2020, the city had $1,501,625 of total net pension liability. That number decreased down to $1,106,533. So it's trending in the right direction. Ultimately, that number will become zero. A couple of contributing factors to that, the biggest one being the fact that the city earned 13.59% on your pension assets during 2020. So that's really helping pull down your net pension liability. That's the second consecutive year of strong market returns, 2019, and then again in 2020, both had right around 13.5-14% rates of return on your pension assets. Because the city's so well funded, you're earning a lot, and that's reducing the long-term burden on the city's general fund and pulling that net pension liability down much faster than most of our local units are seeing. So that's very healthy. And then we've got these other funny deferred inflows and deferred outflows, relatively new elements of financial statements. So about one-third of the way down, we see the deferred outflows of resources, and we have pension-related deferred outflows. And then the five rows up from the bottom, we have pension-related deferred inflows. I won't go into too much detail on that, but to see your deferred pension-related inflows, your deferred inflows related to your pension increasing is healthy. Those are future earnings, or those are excess earnings that will reduce future years' pension expenses. So that's a good thing. When we see very favorable returns on your pension assets, we don't recognize all that income in year one. We spread it over 5 years. So that's the residual amount of excess earnings that we're gonna sprinkle over the next 4 fiscal years and kind of smooth it out so that we don't have so much market volatility impacting your financial statements each year. When we see, conversely, a reduction of your deferred outflows, same thing is happening. I won't go into too much detail. I'll just leave it at decreasing deferred outflows is good. Increasing deferred inflows are good. So they're both trending in the right direction. And it's because the stock market was performing well and you're getting these excess earnings that we get to spread along into the future. Two rows up from the bottom, the unrestricted net position of the city as of April 30, 2020 was $5,766,775, increased up to $6,159,295 at April
30, 2021. Yeah, can I stop you one second? So let's go up to the total current liabilities, though. I caught that earlier on, that we increased by $500,000 our liabilities. And basically, where we're winning the gap as we go further down is the pay down of our long-term debt. Mm-hmm. So I mean that was a concern for me when I was looking through this at the office. I mean, I understand that the current assets came up a little bit stronger, but you know the liabilities are drastically different. Mm-hmm.
And the biggest reason is the accounts payable. So at April 30, 2020. Accounts payable came in at $174,060, increased up to $531,355. A lot of that just has to do with year-end timing of payments. So maybe there's a road project or a large construction project that happened at April 30, 2021, and the contractor is always at least 1 month late submitting the invoices to the city for payment. And in those construction payments, it can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. It doesn't take much for those to become $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 of payments that get paid in May. So they go directly into your current liabilities. And it's a timing issue. It artificially is inflating your current liabilities. If we go up to your total current assets, we see a similar increase in your accounts receivable. So there was $980,861 at April 30, 2020. And then increased up to $1,267,148 on April 30, 2021. What that tells me is, and I don't have my work papers in front of me, most likely there were reimbursement-driven grants that were occurring at the end of the year. So the city increases its receivables, it pulls up your current assets, and then we have these accounts payable that increase as well. So they're kind of increasing, they fluctuate in direct correlation with each other. It's just kind of a timing issue that most local units, especially local units, and I mentioned this to Cindy and Mike, the city always has projects going on. You guys are active. You've always got grants coming in. These are all very healthy signs. And this is just kind of how they manifest themselves in your financial statements. So just a timing issue. Normally you'll see those two line items change in direct correlation to each other, and that's what's going on.
Good.
Thank you. Sure. So, page 20, we get a look at the generated revenues and expenses for the city for the past 2 years. And this is showing you basically how the city has performed. I would think of this as being your income statement over the past couple of years. A couple of healthy trends here. First, if you look the fifth row down, you can see your property taxes increased from $3,438,494 up to $3,675,488. So a very healthy increase in your taxable, in your tax revenues. The biggest reason for that is an increase in taxable value of 2.76%. I think I said 2.6 earlier, but 2.76% is your increase in taxable values. Fairly consistent with where we're seeing our communities in the state of Michigan, somewhere between 2 and 3%. So a little bit on the high end of that range, which is good. These property sales are occurring. It's pulling that number up. It's in excess of inflation, which means that there's just a lot of properties moving. Very good sign. Very next row down, you can see your unrestricted state revenue sharing. It dipped in 2020 because of legislation and COVID, and there was uncertainty with regard to what was going to happen with state aid. That number bounced back and recovered in 2021 up to $731,812. And then if you look at the three rows up at the bottom, change in net position, was a favorable $1,765,426 in 2020 compared to $1,660,754 as of April 30, 2021. So back-to-back years of net income, so to speak, your revenues exceeding your expenses. So again, there's very healthy signs in terms of operating at a sustainable level for multiple years now. We go now to page 33. Here we get a look at the fund financial statements for the city. So these are showing the revenues and the expenditures on the modified accrual basis of accounting. Everything is being cash basis of accounting. And here we can see that your revenues in your general fund came in at $5,093,339. And total expenditures came in at $3,662,058. Transfers out to finance various projects and other funds, $871,676. Altogether, an increase in your general fund balance of $559,625. And then if we go all the way to the very last column, the total governmental funds had a favorable increase in total fund balances of $779,033. So there were two other funds that were deemed major funds. There's a formula that we look at, and according to the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, that tells us what funds we treat as major funds. So local streets and ambulance were considered major funds at April 30, 2021. And then all the other funds of the city are aggregated into the other governmental funds column. But really what I wanted to point out here, your general fund had an increase in fund balance of $560,000. All the other funds had an increase of about $220,000 altogether. So your general fund is doing well. All the other funds of the city are showing increases in fund balance as well for the 12 months ending April 30, 2021. If we go now to page 37, we get a look at the statement of cash flows.
So can we back up to 33 for 1 second?
Sure.
So the transfers out were what we added to the fund balance?
So the transfers out decreased the general fund balance by $871,000.
Correct.
They increased the local street, or they provided additional resources to local streets. Very common. Typically, what cities will do is they'll have various street projects that happen throughout the course of the year, some that may be financed with general resources. So we see the transfer out of the general fund and into the local street funds to subsidize it and make sure that there's enough revenues there to cover those street projects. The ambulance fund, again, $153,149 was transferred into the ambulance fund. There's not quite enough revenues going into the ambulance fund. You can see $928,428 compared to $1,047,300 of expenditures. So because of that, there needs to be a subsidy to protect the fund balance in your ambulance fund. $153,000 was transferred into the ambulance fund to make sure that you maintained a positive fund balance. But for that transfer in, still would have had a positive fund balance, but it would have dwindled down to about $50,000 in the ambulance fund. And then there was another $247,094, I'm assuming probably went into the major street funds. We can look at the combining schedules. That shows the detail of it, but typically for cities, we'll see those transfers out going into various street or capital improvement project funds.
I should just add, with almost every budget, we're transferring money into the major streets, local streets, a fire fund, and EMS fund. Fire and EMS, it's just our share of running those operations. Those aren't profit-making, and we share those expenses with the neighboring townships that contract with us as well, too. But those are pretty much regular expenses every year. On major and local streets, it'll depend on how much we contribute into each fund, depending on which road we're doing or which roads we're doing that given year. Sometimes it's more in major streets, sometimes it's more in local streets. You'll notice this year on the local streets, we drew down the fund balance by about $62,000. We try and keep that pretty close to almost a zero fund balance in major streets and local streets because we're always putting money into it. We always rather keep the money in the general fund in case we need it someplace else, and just keep the major and local streets basically basically washed. So that $62,000 deficit there isn't anything that we were concerned about. It's we were spending down the fund balance that had accumulated over there since we didn't need the money there.
So the money influx comes from the general fund?
Yes. Yes. We subsidize our street funds by about, you know, almost the equivalent of about 4 mils per year. And that's why our streets are so good around town.
Mm-hmm. The only other sources for funding for their streets are your Act 51 funds and your road funds that that 1 mil levy we get
from the county.
So it's pretty limited as far as what the street's going to get. So we rely heavily on all the grants to do some of the bigger projects.
Thanks.
And then page 37 takes us to our statement of cash flows. This is just for your water and sewer fund as well as your equipment fund. And this is a useful schedule because it shows if your rates are set high enough to generate positive cash flows from your water and sewer operations, as well as cover your long-term debt service, as well as infrastructure costs in your utility funds. So the very top section shows net cash provided by operating activities for sewer and water. The third column shows the net impact was a favorable increase in cash from both funds, $826,282. What that means is the amount that you're charging your residents is enough to cover the cost of all the day-to-day operations of your water and sewer utility functions. So it generated positive cash flow of $827,826. The next section down shows how much was used to pay your long-term debt, so your bonds payable, and as well as the interest on those bonds, as well as the purchase of any fixed assets throughout the course of the year. So you can see that a grand total of $841,978 was needed in order to acquire fixed assets, which were $481,020, and then make your principal payments on those bonds, $565,000, as well as the interest on it. And then there's a debt service charge, I believe that's Bowie Mountain, kicks in $226,612 each year to cover their share of that bond payment. Altogether, $841,978 was used for those capital-related activities in the course of the year. And then if you go to the net increase-decrease in cash and investments during the year, you can see that there was a favorable $1,873 increase in cash and investments in water and sewer fund. So basically break-even, which is really what you're shooting for, if not, you know, generating some level of positive cash flow. But you can see that there was $481,000 expended on capital projects during the course of the year. But for that, we would have seen a substantial increase in your cash investments.
Is the water fund balance, you know, the design to set money aside for like big projects, like the one we just voted on down here?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Like, well, that one that was actually out of the wastewater fund for the pump station down here at the Rivermouth. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
That was out of the wastewater fund. But yes, we set aside money for those types of improvements.
Is there a percent typically set aside, or
no? Not a. We look at our capital needs, and what we did a couple of years ago, we had a separate financial consultant, Baker Tilly, we brought in, and we had them do a real deep dive into our water and wastewater funds, and then we also kind of charted out future capital needs on that as well, too. And those are in the reports. Kind of like, you know, one of the reasons Lincoln Street is coming up is because that's one of the mains that's underneath that road for the water system is one that we want to remove or replace. It's an older transite one, I believe.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Just trying to forecast needs and set aside money for the future.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
And that report did confirm that, same as this, that we're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Continuing, if we go to page 39. I mentioned before there was a change in accounting principles right underneath the opinion paragraph. here is the first statement that changed. If you look at last year's audit report, this current tax collection fund was called an agency fund. This year, it's called a custodial fund. So, a sweeping change. That's the first part of the change. If we go to the very next page, page 40, again, still called a custodial fund. But we can see that the city collected $11,032,418 of taxes on behalf of other local units of government. So we know that the city has about $10.3 million of its own revenues. In addition to that, there's another $11 million going into the city and then right back out to the state of Michigan, as well as various other local units of government and schools and so forth. So altogether, about $21 million of and out of the city on an annual basis. Really, that's the only purpose of this financial statement, is just to give readers an understanding of what the true volume is of cash flow. It has no impact. You can see the very bottom row, the net position is zero. None of those funds belong to the city, so it doesn't have any impact on equity, short-term or long-term. So now, all the way to page 62, we get into the footnote section of the audit report.
Joe, could we go to page 44 real sure. quick about it has to do with the Housing Commission?
Sure.
I thought that, and this might be more a question for you, Mike, that the members of the Housing Commission are appointed by you?
Yes.
And not the City Commission?
That's correct.
Yeah, this says that they're appointed by the City Commission.
No, they haven't been.
Yeah, so that probably needs to be updated.
Okay. We can make note. What happens is we take that excerpt from the public ad. I think technically the public ad says the city commission, but
No, it doesn't.
Okay. All right. So yeah, we can update that language to make sure. Any other questions?
No, that was just something that caught my eye.
So on page 62.
Well, let's go back to 44 for a sec.
Sure.
We don't have anything to do with the Housing Commission budget. Why is it in our audit?
It goes back to the Public Act, because the city has some level of control on who is appointed as the governing body. It gets pulled in as a discreetly presented component unit of the city. It seems frivolous to include their financial statements, or maybe even misleading to include them in the city's audit report. They do have their own separate column, so when we look at your fund balances and your net position, none of their finances are included in the city. They have their own separate column. But that is the reason that they get included, is because the city has some minor level of control over them, and for that reason, the Governmental Accounting Standard Board requires us to include them as a discreetly presented component unit. So anytime there's a city, a county, a village that has one of these housing commissions, they have to be reported in somebody's audit, in addition to having their own separately audited set of financial statements.
Because unlike the DDA or the LDFA, where the city commission ultimately approves the budget, we don't approve the budget for the Housing Commission.
Right. So any morsel of control over the governing body pulls them in as a discreetly presented component unit. Okay. So
should the two entities be audited by the same firm, so there's some continuity there?
There's no requirement to do so.
So I noticed that you said they submitted or they were audited. Do you get that information and you look at that information and verify it to its?
Yep, we kick the tires on it and make sure that everything that's getting provided to us seems reasonable. And we have to do a background check on the audit firm and make sure that every 3 years, every audit firm is required to go through a peer review, which means we get audited by external agencies, and they make sure that we're doing all of our duties as a sign that we are carrying out and qualified to do the work. So we pull down their most recent peer review, we pull down the financial statements, we do an analytical review of the numbers, make sure they make sense, and then we include them in the city's audit report after everything checks out.
And if it didn't check out?
Then we would start asking them questions.
And if they couldn't, I mean, at some point, is there a possibility that you'd be telling us, hey, there's a flag or there's some problem over there that you should at least be aware of?
If we didn't feel that we could rely on that, we would have that conversation with
their auditors.
With you, with the city management, with the governing body, and figure out what to do about it. If we felt ultimately that we could not render a clean opinion on your financial statements, we could go in and perform the audit. We've never had that come up. It's always been a reputable firm that's doing it. But technically, we are responsible for those numbers to be correct. And we have to go through, we have steps that we need to follow in order to be able to place reliance on those numbers. And if we feel that we can't place reliance on it, we need to figure out what to do about it instead.
I'm not asking because I'm sure aware of any problems over there. Just curious.
Their audit firm, I can't remember. I think it's, I'd be guessing. Off the top of my head, I know it's a reputable firm. There's only a half dozen firms that do housing commissions in the state of Michigan. So, page 62 brings us to the net pension liability footnote disclosure for the city. And really, I wanted to point out the bottom schedule here. These schedules are relatively new. Although I guess it's the seventh year that the city has implemented the newer pension reporting standards. One of the schedules that I find to be useful is this sensitivity analysis at the bottom of the page. At April 30, 2021, we measured, or the actuaries measured the net pension liability for the city at $1,117,870. That's assuming that all the assets, pension assets, set aside by the city are going to earn a long-term rate of return of 7.6%. Over the next 10 years. If the actual rate of return is 8.6%, there will be more investment earnings. It puts less of a burden on the city. It reduces your liability by about $800,000 to $307,541. So the idea here is to show readers what happens if the market does better than expected. Conversely, if the market only earns a real rate of return of 6.6%, the number increases about $900,000 up to $2,069,045, and that would require the city to fund an additional $900,000 over the next 10 years to fully fund the net pension liability. So it doesn't really mean anything other than it gives readers a general understanding of what market conditions can do to future cash flows of the city. Continuing on, if we go down to page 69.
Where do we fall right now?
Well, 12 months ended December, or the calendar year 2020 was 13.59%. Calendar year 2019 was 14%. Year to date, 2021, is certainly north of 7.6%. Hopefully, things continue the next 17 days. Hopefully, are north of 7.6%. The city will have a third consecutive year of beating that number. This is entirely set by the MERS pension report, so this isn't something that the city doesn't have a vote per se. This is an estimate that the city comes up with. It's really dictated and determined by Lansing and or the MERS board, and it flows through to the city's financial statements.
I should mention, pension is something that we've talked about for a long time with the city commission. About 17 years ago, we switched primarily from a defined benefit program to a defined contribution program, so we know what our costs are. But it's taken us a while to basically close out our liabilities with regards to the defined benefit program. And we're kind of hitting the top of a spike that's going to hit either in the next couple of years of our cost. We would really have to fund it up to its highest level. Then all of a sudden those costs really drop down. See all the benefits that we did for this decision we made about 17 years ago to define contributions.
What year is that drop? For the projected year?
It'll actually start taking, it's expected to take effect in the our fiscal year beginning in 2024. So we only got a couple more years yet.
Then it'll peak in 2024.
No, that'll actually be the first year that it drops.
It drops.
Yep. It's actually supposed to peak in the fiscal year and beginning next year.
What's the nuts and bolts of that, Mike, that caused that drop?
Basically, we've funded, right now we're at an 82% funding level, and we have, you know, a lot of people that have retired under that program in the past. We don't have that many more people left that are going to retire under that program, but you know, more people are, you know, dying and things like that, so that our liability decreases under that eventually.
Okay.
So we're just kind of working our way through that cycle where fewer people are going to be drawing on those resources, and we funded them so well over the years that the money we have to put in to fund future years is really going to drop down.
Gotcha.
So it's taken us a long time to get there, but we're going to go, just for an example here, and these are estimates that they gave us in about a year ago, and I provide this every year with the budget. We had a contribution for fiscal year beginning this year of $494,000. Next year is projected to be $507,000. So that's the peak year. That's how much we have to kick in. Then it drops down to $340,000. And then $72,000. So that's going to free up resources for us to use in other areas or reduce taxes or whatever we want to do going forward. So we're almost over that hurdle that we've been striving for a number of years. So that's part of the long-term financial planning we've been doing. And it's been tight these last few years to do it, but again, we're still in pretty good shape.
I was here for when we were paying nothing, because the employees that were working were funding those that retired. So I was here as that cycle, as that started increasing, we made the correct change, and now to see it drop, it's good, because there are only six people left that are still working as part of the defined benefit.
Was anybody hired before 17 years ago, I suppose?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So since 2004.
But we still have, you know, we have six people left in the system that are still working.
Correct.
But we have a number of retirees and or their spouses are still drawing on those pensions, and they will until the time that they're
31
completely
or something
gone.
Like that.
Right.
A couple items on page 69. So note 14.
Can we back up to 68 for 1 second? What's the bottom paragraph on 68? Probably a question for Mike, I guess. What settlement? $311,000?
Yes, Lexingar got overbilled for some of their payments, and we provided them the refund. Their account, they switched a staff person in their organization that caught it.
You said Lexingar?
Yes. Yep, Magnum. In the business park, they're one of our bigger water customers, and that overage was for a number of years, and we covered it. We basically returned that to them.
Big return.
Yep. No, they documented it. We went over the numbers with the attorneys and all that type of stuff to make sure that everything was on file. And Mark and Jane went over those numbers in great detail. Mark Fowler, Jane Halstead, our billing clerk, and we went over that with Charlie over there at Lexamar and some of their financial people.
How did it happen to you?
That I'd asked to have Mark describe with regards to it. It's in part Marty because they have what's called a compound meter. Basically, it's a two-stage water meter. So instead of having, you know, like the one water meter that we have in our homes, that just has a 3/4-inch size, and sometimes if there's not much going on in the plant, they use the small half of that compound meter, and it just is recording the 3/4. You know, if they're just flushing water in the toilets or something like that. But if they have some major process that's going on there, they go to what's the bigger meter, which might be like a 3-inch meter or something like that. It's all one unit, but it flows from one to the other. And depending on the amount of water flow, if it gets too much for the little meter to handle, it goes to the big meter. Our utility billing program was calculating those two incorrectly instead of either adding them or subtracting. It was adding or subtracting them wrong, and we ended up billing them too much. It was basically a direct result of them having a compound meter.
That settlement payment, is that a direct cost of the overage, or is there interest on that?
Yeah, it's a direct cost of the overage.
And it come out of the?
Water fund.
Water fund.
Yep. The money went into the water fund, it came out of the water fund.
So, page 69, we've got just a couple of paragraphs here explaining, again, the new accounting pronouncement. So, GASB Statement Number 84, we're explaining that fiduciary activities was implemented during the year. There was no impact on beginning fund balance as a result of that. And then the next paragraph down, the city's farmer's market used to be included as a department of the general fund. Because the general fund was subsidizing its operations. So governmental accounting statement board statement number 54 required us to include that as a department of the general fund. Now that the farmer's market is up and running, it's generating enough revenues to sustain its operation. We split it out and moved it into its own special revenue fund to comply with governmental accounting standard board statement 54. So it took $54,000 of restricted fund balance out of the general fund and it moved into its own special revenue fund. Not exactly a sweeping change, but again, did have an impact. If we tried to compare beginning fund balance to your general fund on this year's audit report to ending fund balance on last year's audit report, we would see a difference of $54,129. We're just trying to explain that and make sure readers understand why. Page 74. This is a, I guess it's 7 years, this is 6 years, schedule showing this changes in the city's net pension liability. And a couple of rows here that I think are worth pointing out. Like Mike said, 15, 16, 17 years ago, changes were made to who is eligible to participate in the defined benefit pension plan. As a result of that, the number of active employees have been decreasing over time. The very top row shows in 2015 the normal cost or the service cost of providing benefits to active employees is dwindling each year. So I don't know what the number originally began at, but I know that, like Cindy said, it's down to six employees, at least in 2021. 2020, there were seven active employees. Maybe Cindy might have been the one that took it from seven down to six. So that number keeps on trending down. And because of that, the service cost on an annual basis is following suit. And that number will continue until it goes all the way down to zero, given that it's a closed plan. So Mike said that in 2024, the total pension payment is going to be around $72,000. It might even be less than that, because really, once the city's fully funded, that's the number that's going to be paid in on an annual basis. So if you're at 100% funding and your service cost is zero, theoretically your investment earnings are going to equal your interest on the total pension liability. There should be no additional burden on your general fund. Now, of course, that's assuming that the city earns exactly 7.6% on your pension assets. So in a year where it's less than 7.6, the city's going to need to pay an extra the following year to get it back up to 100%. Conversely, you guys might actually have a net pension asset at some point in the future if rates are above and beyond 7.6%. Three rows further down, we can see changes in assumptions. 2020, because of changes in at the MERS retirement board, what they did, they looked at mortality rates in 2020. They bumped, or they used a different mortality rate table, which assumed or extended the basically the life expectancy of, I believe, the females. So that pulled up the change or the total pension liability, because the lives were expected to be longer as a result of that change in the mortality table. 2019, the MERS Retirement Board decreased your expected rate of return. It used to be 8%. They dropped it down to 7.6%. That pulled up your liability another $277,019. And then back in 2015, they did the same thing again. They decreased the city's expected long-term rate of return from 8.25% down to 8%. So three times they've changed your assumptions. It's pulled up your total pension liability, if I overrate $800,000, eventually that should stop, or maybe we'll have some assumptions that favorably decrease. It just so happens that all three of the assumption changes have pulled up the city's net pension liability. If you look about halfway down the page, we see the net investment income. So 2020, a favorable $940,489, or about 13.59%. 2019, favorable $899,338. So those 2 years, we've had very strong investment returns, and that certainly is helping bring down the city's net pension liability, in addition to those annual recorded contributions. If you look two rows up from there, the employer contributions, the city contributions, $427,105 for the 12 months ended December 31st, 2020. This is on the plan year as opposed to the city's fiscal year. So $427,000 compared to your service cost of $59,823, the difference being how much the MERS board wants you to keep chipping away at your net pension liability until you get to that 100% funding level. And you can see that has been fairly consistent. It's trending up. 2015, $222,000. It's up to $427,000. It could peak as high as $507,000 in 2023. Eventually, it will come down. And you can see the difference between your pension assets, your pension liability came in at $1,117,870, down from $1.5 million. And your funding percentage was 82.99% in 2019, up to 87.91% at December 31st, 2020. We take a look at a snapshot. I just know what our clients' average funding percentage is. So we've got 30 clients that are funded through MERS for their defined benefit pension plan. On average, we're seeing 70%. So you guys are almost 18% better than what the average is for other similar communities.
Similar in size?
Mm-hmm. What was the average again, Joe? I'm sorry.
70%.
Some communities really got hit hard.
I've got some local units that are at 40%.
And that's because they didn't make that move 17 years ago.
Right. So these past 2 years of 14% investment earnings aren't doing them any good because they don't have enough. They don't have any assets
there to get interest on.
They missed their window of opportunity. Now they're going to have to cover all of that unfunded cost on their general fund, and it's going to put a big burden on their budget for, you know, the next, for them, 15 to 20 years. They're going to be saddled with it. So you guys are in great shape.
You'd be surprised how many communities, there was a real large discussion probably about a year ago about other communities having to go have special millages just to be able to pay their pension costs. So.
Grand Traverse County?
Yeah. Yep. The terrible.
Port Huron?
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Is there any protection once you get to that point, though?
The market volatility is a risk that will always be borne by the city until you get to the point where, I mean, we're probably 50, 60 years away from that, but I mean, there would have to be nobody left on the plan before the market loss or the market risk is completely gone from the city.
Yeah, is there a point sometime where you have enough cashing and you just get out of the market?
Right. Yeah.
I suppose you
FIC
could,
or
you
have it insured somehow.
Buy employees out and see if they'd be willing to take a cash.
Nope. Well, I wouldn't if I was them.
That's really about the only way to do it.
Yeah.
I said you'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. You wave cash, people grab.
Have we done any
first MERS check comes this week?
Ooh, how much is that going to be, George? Just kidding. So what, have we done like a projection of what the pension will be for a current employee versus an employee under the defined benefit plan?
No.
How they compare?
No. Those pension programs are not as strong.
I think there's contributions you can do on your own, too. I think there's some variables in there.
We put provide for all of our employees 8% of their wages on top. So they have a wage figure, then 8% on top of that. It goes into a pension, their defined contribution program. that they can choose how they want to.
Is there a 10-year investment timeline on that?
Seven on that one. 7 years? 7 on that one, and then 4 for certain individuals, but yes, 7.
Do you get vested?
Yes.
Yeah. I hit my 10-year. I got mine.
So, just a couple other schedules that I find they have useful information. If you go to page 103. How is the city's total debt compared to its legal debt margin? And the city's only at 22%. Not saying that you guys can go issue a bunch of bonds, I'm not encouraging that, but the 22%, I find that to be useful just to know you guys are well within the legal limits of what your total bonds outstanding can be. And this just shows over the past 10 years where the city has been, the numbers trending down. There were bonds issued for the purchase or construction of the city facilities. That's where the number began in 2016, and it keeps on waning down to the $6,023,520. So again, 22%, very healthy, very much underneath the legal debt margin. I've got some local units that are pushing up against that 100% level. So you guys are very strong. The very next page, page 104.
Is there a recommended percentage?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my question.
It just depends on what the comfort level is of the governing body. So 22% is certainly in line with where most of our local units are.
Okay. So it isn't higher. Nope. That's right in the ballpark. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't recommend that we do any more bonding or getting in debt or anything like that?
No.
Let's have a discussion on that right now, because you know, if we do the marina project,
if we do the marina project,
there will be more bonds for that as well.
Right.
And there's already been an opinion provided by Miller Canfield, our bond counsel, saying that one, we have the bond capacity to do that, and again, that's all supposed to be handled by the marina itself as it goes forward. So there might be a depending on where the commission goes, there may be another $6 or $8 million that would be bonded to part of that.
And the sewer plants, we don't have many years left on the sewer plant and the water infrastructure improvements.
Correct. Yeah, those are going to roll off pretty soon too.
What's the year those run off? Do you know?
Oh, I mentioned it in the budget narrative. Let me see if I can take
this through. We're at 1.785.
Hang on a sec.
I think that was about 26.
Yeah, that's what I thought, 2026.
The other one, the water, is a couple years earlier.
Let's see. Drinking water fund we pay off, and final payment is in fiscal year 2023. The wastewater treatment plant is 2026. This building is 2037. And the only other one that we have out there is for the West Michigan Street. And that's an internal debt, that's not a bond, that's for that special assessment that was done for the water main extension out there. And that's those people paying it off, and that runs through 2039.
And that's where the city paid for that, then they're paying the city back.
Correct. It was better off financially for everybody involved. It was cheaper for us and for them to not sell bonds and to finance it ourselves and get the 3.5% interest rather than what we're getting at the bank, which is like nothing. So it saved them money, it earned us money, and it reduced the cost because you didn't have to go up for bonding expenses as well too. So we basically self-financed that project for those people. And that project, the current outstanding debt was just under $300,000, $283,000. So, and that's all in your budget book under tab 10 as to what our debt summary is, if you want to look any of those up.
So the very next schedule shows revenue bonds, and again, for both the water and sewer funds. This just shows how much revenue is being generated from both your water and sewer funds compared to your annual debt service requirements, and then it looks at the ratio. Is there enough revenues to be able to cover your debt service. And that's what the coverage ratio is. It's right in the middle of the page, directly to the right of the debt service columns. The city is ranging anywhere from 0.91 up to 1.2. It's been as high as 1.31. It means for every $1.20 of income that you're generating from your sewer fund, you're making a debt service payment. So you're generating positive cash flows, more than enough to be able to cover your annual required principal and interest payments out of the sewer fund. We look at the same analysis in your water revenue or in your water fund compared to the water revenue bonds. Your income or your free cash flow on an annual basis in the water fund is generating 3.17 times your annual required principal and interest payments. So water fund, 3.17 times more cash flows being generated than your debt service requirement. Sewer fund, 1.2, both of those are very healthy.
Is this 3.17, is that, I mean, where does it become excessive? When does it become maybe time to start lowering water payments?
Well, there's a lot more analysis than just this, because you also have to remember there are long-term capital needs. There needs to be these utility funds need to be generating enough cash flow to cover not only the debt service, but the future capital investments in those funds as well. So at some point, what was it, 2026, these bonds are going to drop off, so it's going to become infinite at that point. So I guess we have to kind of look at these ratios with a grain of salt. The bottom line is you're generating more than enough to be able to meet your debt service requirements. But that's just one piece of the puzzle. We need to make sure that there's enough there to cover those future capital projects as well.
Okay. George, tying into that, when we had the fund analysis done for the water and the wastewater system, one of the discussions we had was, hey, these debts are going to be rolling off. We're going to have all this, you know, potentially have, you know, make too much money.
Right.
And what do we want to, what's the plan for that? And one of the discussions that the commission was having was, there's still a large part of Boyne City itself where we don't have water and sewer. The people are on wells and septics. And should we be looking at plans to expand those service areas so more people are on our water and sewer system and don't have to worry about wells or septics at some point in the future? So that was one discussion to possibly use some of that revenue for.
What would be really the advantage to the city to put more people on the water and sewer? I mean, if they're getting their water out of the ground and they have their own sewer system, their own septic, I mean, what's
the advantage? What helps people in the long term is it gets them out of the water and sewer business. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, every 15 or 20 years, somebody has to replace a well or replace a septic system or things like that. And the problem that we have right now is, you know, like on Cindy Street, on Earl Street, you know, everybody's house happens at a different time. If we could coordinate that, you know, and put them all on one project together and replace them all at once, or all the wells went bad or all the septics went bad at one time, you would end up saving them money overall and have a more reliable water sewer system. And it also provides, especially on the water side of it, you know, when we extend the water mains, you have better fire protection and things of that nature as well.
Okay.
Too.
Well, thank you. That makes sense.
In the 38 years we've had our house, we have city water, but we don't have city sewer.
Oh.
We probably got like $10,000 in septic, replacing drain field, whatever. So if the sewer runs down Lincoln Street, it's going to be pretty life changing for us, because we can make some big changes.
I see.
That we want to do. Wait. Garage.
Same with me, but yes. But your question's legitimate, because let's say out there by Roosevelt Street, you're a block from the sewer system, and they're all private well or septics.
Mm-hmm.
What would incentivize them to change over? You know,
right.
They may not want to, because they don't have $6,000 to $8,000 cash. But no, the hookup would be $3,000 for the city, but they just. Like Mike said, if you hit the whole neighborhood, everybody's not going to want to, because they don't have the cash and their system is currently working. How does the city provide an existing neighborhood water and sewer? It It's a lot easier to provide a new neighborhood water and sewer.
Sure, sure.
So we've debated this every year. There's no answer.
We're on a septic as well.
You are?
Yeah, on Hemlock.
That whole
they just built two houses next to me, and they're on septic on Daly Street. Habitat for Humanity, the houses.
Yeah.
We tap into the city sewer instantly if we have the opportunity.
Just for the peace of mind and that it's not your problem anymore.
And it also gives them more flexibility on how they use their property. They don't have to reserve a big chunk of it for a septic system.
Yeah.
Or a certain distance from the septic to the well and that type of stuff.
Right.
It really just, it chews up their property so they can't have more buildings on it and things of that nature.
Our garage has
to
be, our garage could not be any further back because it sits at that drain field.
Yeah.
So.
But when people say, you know, we want water and sewer, it's complicated. Like okay, if we do Lincoln Street, we put a spur down Earl Street,
your street,
and Lewis Street, and High Street, and Grant Street. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
If you did, who's going to hook up?
Is that on the table though? Is putting spurs down those side streets?
Well,
yep.
Well,
in the future. In the future, yes. And a matter of fact, on one of the maps that's in the from the on the Lincoln Street plan, you'll see a service area. Where that's outlined in, like, I think it's like
green
blue
dots.
Or green dots,
yeah,
the
yeah.
hash lines. We had C2A look at, okay, what would it take to expand that? And we're kind of setting the stages to at least consider that as an option going forward at a future project.
Can those pipes be stubbed out?
Yes.
I mean, since you have the root street's going to be torn up, stub it out towards High Street, towards Earl Street.
The stubs are being put out where the project ends to be able to continue it on without having to dig up the road.
Okay.
Yep.
That's already in the
plan. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
To where it ends right now, though.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get up close enough to Earl Street to stub it for that.
This one?
Yeah. Not in this project.
Okay. We'll be back.
I'm certainly happy to take any further questions.
Was that the end of your report on page 104?
Yep.
That was it?
That's it.
This was much easier to read through this last night.
Well, you know,
funny thing, was he hit on most of my eyes?
He did.
And this will make more and more sense as we go, you know, if you have some experience going through this and going through the budget. It all builds on each other, and then you should be able to start seeing where they all tie together and hopefully make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, this actually was very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions other people have for Joe? I mean, this is the time to pick his brain. Joe, do you want to? These are kind of off subject, but I'm going to hit on them anyway, just unless somebody else has some questions. Do you want to talk about the state's chart of accounts update?
Sure.
At all?
Well, all right. Sorry. I was just wondering, with the money that we're getting, the like COVID money or whatever.
Yes.
$195,000
this year and $195,000 coming next year, plus whatever else might trickle down the road later on.
Right. Yeah. This was good to figure out. Is that something with working with these other local municipalities, is that something that you're helping the commissions or helping those governing bodies find areas for those funds to be utilized?
We can. It really depends on each local unit's
needs. Yeah.
Right. So if I have a client that has $390,000 of ARPA funds that they're going to be collecting,
right.
But they have a $600,000 infrastructure project, they don't need us.
Right.
Where it gets tricky is, okay, we're getting, you know, $400,000 of ARPA funds. We don't know what to spend them on.
Mm-hmm.
Then we can start providing them with some options that they can consider and bring to their governing body to make, I guess, more informed decisions in terms of how much flexibility they have on those funds. It's fairly rigid. There's four different categories. Three of the four categories are fairly structured, and they need to be expended on specific purposes. One where the local units get some an a high degree of latitude with how they get expended is through the revenue loss, and that's normally where we step in and provide some consulting or assistance to our clients, just so they can look and identify, okay, of that $400,000 that we're receiving, we can attribute $125,000 per year of that to revenue loss, and then we can use it on public safety or health and welfare. It just gives them a tremendous amount of flexibility to be able to use those funds,
right,
as opposed to coming up with very specific plans for infrastructure renewal.
Right. And the only reason I ask is because everyone in the public's going to have their opinion on where that money needs to be utilized. Obviously, we as commissioners have insights that the majority of the public, you know, won't take advantage of looking or getting, but you have a lot of insight and knowledge, and I would feel comfortable if somehow, some way, I don't know how often, we have the opportunity to pick your brain with a contract that we have to try and get some input from your firm, and identifying locations and where that money would be good.
Sure.
Do you just charge a percentage of whatever the amount of money you're looking at? Is that how you set your fee?
It's an hourly rate.
An hourly rate?
Yeah. And you can use the ARPA funds to pay us, so. It is one of the eligible uses, believe it or not, so, yeah.
Is that just for calculating the lost revenues, or?
That's primarily what I will typically do is provide our clients with a revenue loss calculation and kind of give them some guidance. Okay, it doesn't give them full reign to expend those funds. They can't just use it for anything they want to. So with that, I will point them in the direction that they can use them and give them suggestions that other local units are using those funds towards. And then I hand it off to them and let them make the decisions from that point on. So
for a community our size, and you obviously know our books pretty well, what do you think it would take cost-wise estimate to do that study, so to speak?
Typically, ballpark. Anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 is normally where we end up. The tricky part is we have to go back and do 4 years worth of analysis.
Yes.
And then we look at your revenue loss as of 2020, and then we do it three more times, 2021, 2022, 2023, obviously. Well, soon we'll be able to calculate it as of December 31st, 2021. The tricky thing is when we look backwards, it's based on a fiscal year. So we would look at fiscal April 30, 2017, 2018, and 2019. And then for some reason, the Fed switched it to a calendar year. And then we look at calendar year 2020, 2021. 2020. It makes it a little bit more complex because we have to extract the data out of BSNA and make it work for that analysis. It's not as simple as looking at four years worth of audit reports until you know. So does BSNA come up with a report that you can do that yet? Well, yes, they do have a report. The problem is
you still have
it. It's not on the modified accrual basis of accounting. It requires a little bit of work to make it work.
How long does it take to do a report such as that?
Anywhere from 15 to 30 hours, which is where the fees come in.
Where I'm thinking of, like, if the commission wanted to tell you that, like, at our meeting in January, saying, hey, we'd like to know if, you know, if there is that lost revenue that, you know, we can basically claim and put into the general fund so the commission has the most latitude on how they want to use that. If we told you in January, how long would it take for us to get that data? I mean, are you booked up? Is it going to see it in April, or is it something that you can do in February or 2 weeks? Okay. Pretty quick.
Yeah. And we could provide an engagement letter for you guys to review
and sign. And I didn't even mean bring it up to railroad the whole
discussion
thing between the commissioners. Obviously, we got to have a discussion and see what we agree on, but I just wanted to see if it was an option because I know there's a critical thinking process in how to spend money, the best way to spend money. So,
Joe, I have a question. On page 24 or 23, there's this letter. Yeah, 24. We get into this letter, and I don't think you wrote it. I think, you know, Mike had a hand in writing that. And I just wonder what, you know, we're sitting here looking at an independent audit, and then there's nothing that references that this information came from the city manager. Is there a reason why that is?
Sure. So that is the one section of the audit report where the management of the city has the ability to provide narrative. And in fact, this is in the required supplemental information section of the audit report, and we specifically disclaim an opinion on this for that reason. So if you were to look at the independent auditor's report, and if you look at underneath the emphasis of matter or the change in accounting principle paragraph, the very next paragraph talks about the type of opinion we provide on required supplemental information. So we basically acknowledge, yeah, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board requires this to be included in the audit report. We look at it, but we don't disclaim an opinion, or we disclaim our opinion on it. So it does give, for that reason, management the ability to provide useful information to the residents without us having to render an opinion on the accuracy of something that obviously is a degree of judgment that goes into it.
I just don't see where the casual observer would know that this wasn't you speaking. That, you know, if it was just noted that this...
I think, and I guess I'm thinking on behalf of the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, the reason that we aren't, they don't tell us to explain that, is the fact that this section of the audit report is called Management's Discussion and Analysis, and maybe the presumption is that management is directing it. According to the Governmental Accounting Standards Board, we are supposed to show up, and management is supposed to give us this report. That's, I mean, read the accounting statements, that's how audits are supposed to work. We have 225 clients in the state of Michigan. Nobody does that. Unless maybe the city of Detroit does, or Chicago, or the state
nobody,
of Michigan.
Nobody knows that this was from the city manager, not
our city.
Go to page 14. Page 14 is where it says.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, page 14 says manager.
I mean, that whole section from page 14 through page 27 is that management's discussion and analysis.
And that, when I was looking at the table of contents, that's kind of how I broke it up, too. Because page 28 in the table of contents is essentially where you're starting.
Well, they have stuff before on right. Page 13 and stuff like that. They've got, like, their letter that he talks about and that type of thing.
Yeah, the introduction is a firm in that, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay.
Can you tell us about your accounts?
Yes.
I asked that question. So the commission knows what you're up to and what we're up to as well.
Sure. So over the past 3 or 4 years, perhaps longer, State of Michigan has been refining a new chart of accounts that local units are required to adopt, and they finally have published a due date. So April 30, 2023 is the first year that the city is going to be subject to the new chart of accounts reporting, or the new chart of accounts requirements. So that means that April 1st, 2022, the city should have, not required, but should have its new chart of accounts in place to use on a go-forward basis. I talk about how a lot of these new accounting changes aren't exactly sweeping changes. The new chart of accounts isn't exactly a sweeping change. All of the line items that the city is used to seeing, office supplies in the clerk's department, office supplies in the clerk treasurer's department, all of those things are still going, they were present on your old chart of accounts, they will be present on the new chart of accounts, but they will have slightly different nomenclature for the numbers used to identify those line items. So it won't change your budget process, it's just going to change the look. When you look at your actual trial balance, the actual account codes are going to be different, and it's going to take department heads a little bit of a learning process to learn, okay, wait a second, I used to sign off on this invoice and I used to use this account number. What's the new account number now? So there's going to be a little bit of learning that needs to happen by anybody who's signing off on invoices that need to be paid and recorded into the city's accounting ledger. altogether, I would guess maybe 125 changes.
It's about that. It's we had the last revision that I emailed to you.
I saw it. I'll get a look at it this week and let you know. Some of the, one example, I think your supplies account used to be 027, the object code, now it's going to be 052. It's kind of a somewhat type of a change, but it still needs to be complied with to meet all of Treasury's reporting requirements. So that's a lot of what Cindy is doing, and maybe Jessica as well, to go through excruciating detail through BSNate and make sure that every single one of those lines gets updated to what Treasury is requiring. Once everything is submitted, it gets submitted to BSNate will schedule a time with the city to go ahead and log on online remotely and publish all of those changes, and it happens to be behind the scenes for the city. So it's been like, it might be 5 years now in the making.
Yeah,
what's the reason for that?
Consistency and financial reporting a little bit more. Treasury wants to be able to look at the city of Boyne City, compare you guys to the city of Cadillac and the city of Big Rapids. And if they have a uniform chart of accounts that everybody is adopting with similar departments, similar object codes, similar fund numbers, they think it will give them a higher degree of comparability between various local units.
That makes sense.
I think we only had to change a couple of fund numbers, which wasn't too bad. One of the biggest changes is going to be the Marina Fund.
Oh,
that's the one we need.
Yes.
I was hoping that we could talk about.
So the Marina Fund on your financial statements right now is treated as a special revenue fund, which means that when we look at the special revenue fund, it means it's primarily financed with taxes or state aid or grants. Really, the Marina Fund financed primarily with charges for services. So you've got transient and various other slip charges and rentals throughout the course of the year. That's your primary source of funding. It's really intended to be operated more like a business as opposed to a government. For that reason, Michigan Department of Treasury wants that to be treated as a business type fund, just like your water and sewer fund, as opposed to a governmental fund. So that's going to be the one geography change that you will see. In future audit reports, we're going to take that. The Marina Fund is buried in those combining statements and schedules in the back end of the report. It's going to slide out of those schedules. It used to be a non-major fund. It's now, or will be, a non-major business-type fund. So it's going to be water fund, sewer fund, Marina Fund, as opposed to just a water and sewer fund.
So that's probably the biggest change as far as.
And that's determined by a cash amount level of money that's flowing through that to determine whether it needs to go, or?
Because the primary source of funding, I mean, certainly there could be some level of governmental funds that go into the Marina Fund to subsidize it in certain years, but because the primary source of funding is charges to the users of the Marina, Treasury wants it to be treated like a business-type fund. And because we are changing the location, so we're taking it out of governmental funds and moving it to business type. It's best practice for the governing body to approve that type of a change.
So we have a similar situation with the airport, where most of its revenues are generated by users of the airport, either in hangar fees or fuel charges and things like that. That one is not changing, though, apparently. So they're still using the same processes. Marina's a lot larger financially than the airport. So is that the differential, why one's moving and one's not?
Some of our clients do have a level of governmental assistance that goes into the airports. They might receive governmental grants. It's not unusual to see significant, kind of like the MDOT grants that the city receives for street repair projects. There's a certain bucket of money that comes from MDOT that goes into these airports. And in many cases, especially for the larger airports, it's kind of a recurring transaction on an annual basis. So in that case, at least in Treasury's eyes, they're considering that to be a governmental fund because a substantial portion of the funding is coming through grants. So
I can't wish that was the case for our airport.
Yeah.
Last big grant we got from that was about 21, 22 years ago.
That's been a long time. One of the, I guess, in a way it's perfect that the timing is perfect for this because new DPW director, new treasurer, as far as learning those account numbers, I'm telling you, Jessica, don't pay attention. I'm not going to run you the chart of accounts. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it because things are going to change. So when that happens, that's when we're really going to focus on that. So
those changes that you're talking, isn't that mostly software?
Just numbers. I'm just changing numbers. You know, like Joe said, supplies is going to change from, you know, in the Amazon from 101, 173, 727 to 101, 173.
I guess an updated software package would seem to have the changes.
That's what BSNA is going to do. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why we all believe that BSNA is the best in the industry for us, is because this conversion will happen for us. We don't have to do anything other than to verify that those account numbers are correct. And yes, it's taken a lot of work in the meantime between Joe and I, and Richard spent a little time with us too. But they're doing all the back end work for us and making it all happen. So when we run a 12-year summary, it's going to pull. So it will be seamless as far as what you're seeing. We're not going to have Fund 285 all of a sudden stopping in December of 2021. It's just going to be seamless.
Okay.
So you won't have to spend a lot of time. You'll have to learn a few new funds, but everything else should be seamless for you.
Unfortunately for us, a number of years ago, probably 15 or 16 years ago, we took the airport and the marina out of the general fund and created their own fund so we could track them separately. Before they were lumped in, you never knew if they were making money or how much their contribution was from the general fund. Now you can see, and we haven't had contributions to either the marina or the airport, right, 16, 17 years. It's been a long time. They've operated pretty much on their own.
Cemetery, we always will have to.
Yes.
Okay, any other things?
The only other thing I wanted to bring up, as long as Joe's here and people are getting to know him, last time we went out for bids or got quotes from them, they gave us a 5-year proposal. The commission at that time accepted a 3-year term on that. They gave us a quote for an additional 2 years, which was 1.4% increases for each of those years. Their last year under the 3 years is up with this audit. So at our next meeting in January, we figured we had enough on this meeting already. And you hadn't met Joe before, and we wanted you to get comfortable with him a little bit first before bringing that to you, because we're going to bring to the commission the consideration of a possible extension of their contract for those 2 more years. I think the 1.4%, I mean, is just rock bottom. It's a really, compared to what prices are going up these days. Glad you're sticking to that number. And two, another, you know, it's good to go out and test the waters and go out for bids every so often. We've had very good luck with them, and with the transition from Cindy to Jessica, I think it'd be good for Jessica to get a couple of years under her belt with this experience behind them before we then go out to bids.
So what's your tenure with the city?
How long?
We are 8 years in.
8 years.
I don't know how many firms do this that have BSNA, but to make that investment in that software, so an audit right now is not just the auditor saying, hey, we're going to need, you know, this data, and you know, getting general ledgers and randomly picking out data that they're going to need to, you know, check items from start to finish. They see everything that we do. By that upload,
So we've got all that data. And the one other thing that I will say, 8 years, I know some people may think that seems long. We do rotate staff, so we make sure that we're going to get to turn over different stones. We've got different managers coming in. We've got different staff coming in to make sure that we don't have any type of familiarity threat with the city. At the same time, I've always been the in charge of the engagement, so that we aren't asking Cindy the same question every single year they come to me, they ask me the questions that we internally should already know so we don't pester our clients. At the same time, we've got different people who have different approaches and take a different auto approach. And altogether, we've got 35 staff, and we try to make sure that we're switching things up to keep things fresh on an annual basis. So.
How many man hours does this represent?
Roughly 150 to 175, somewhere in that range.
You've got to love you numbers.
Love County.
Yeah. God bless you, man.
The last thing I'd say is we went through this fairly quickly. I appreciate you guys apparently taking the time to dive into it before. If you ever have any questions, when this isn't done now, if you think of something in the middle of the night, write it down. Let Jessica know. We'll get it to them and get you an answer on it as well, too. So it's a continual learning process.
Okay, with that, we're getting close to moving to our regular session, so yeah, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn this meeting.
I support.
So moved.
Okay, Marty moved and Tim supported. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Okay, we'll gather again in a few minutes.
Yeah, about 20 minutes.
You got a business card, Jim?
I do.
So you're at Grand Rapids then?
Yes.